You're listening to the Wake Up Podcast with Alex Fetsky, the place where the most dynamic thinkers and practitioners in the world drop truth bombs and contrarian viewpoints to help you become the best version of yourself. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 92 of the Wake Up Podcast. On this one, I've got John Vallis with me again. And this time we're not doing Money Messiah, we're actually doing the first part of a series of episodes I'm going to do about psychedelics. And the question is, psychedelics, demonic or divine? So this is a deep first discussion. I chose John because he's both experienced in psychedelics, but also well-read and respective of kind of the Christian side, and he's conservative. He's got all the values I want on both sides of the argument and of the thinking. So this is a great discussion. Have a listen. Let me know your thoughts. I've got multiple guests coming up after this one. So I'm going to have Thomas Strohlite. I'm going to have Will Spencer. I'm going to have Bitcoin Mechanic, Grassfed Bitcoin. I'm going to have Brandon Quinnham. I'm going to have a whole series of people discussing both the for and against position. And the qualifying criteria, as you'll hear me mention later in the show, is that they've had experience with the substance. This isn't, as Thomas Strohlite would talk about, like a blue cheese situation where you're talking to someone who hasn't tried the shit and is talking out their ass. So this is going to be a whole series of deep discussions, and I hope, at the very least, it makes you question how you approach these substances if this is something you want to do. And if you don't do these or want to do these or anything, it at the very least makes you appreciate that there are exceptions to the rule with some people who may want to use them as introspection enhancing substances. So enjoy the show. Remember to follow, give it a review because we want to get it in front of a few more people, and share the episode itself on Twitter, everywhere else. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first of a series of podcasts I'm going to do called the Psychedelic Series, Divine or Demonic. Couldn't figure out a better subtext to give it. And for episode number one, I've got my man here, John Vallis, joining me. John, thank you, brother.
It's always a pleasure, brother. Looking forward to this.
Absolutely. So for those listening, obviously you're not going to be watching this on YouTube because I decided not to do videos. A, because where I'm at is shit. And B, I'm actually thinking I'm just doubling down on audio because it's just a better format and 95% of my listeners are on there. So FYI, for those wondering why this is not on YouTube, it ain't going to be there. So anyway, let's kick this off. So the psychedelic series is going to be an exploration of, you know, what are these substances? Why are we using them? What does their use mean? What does ancient use look like, or, you know, modern use? And obviously, you know, ancient use we can only kind of speculate on, at least, you know, to the best of our knowledge. You know, and are we treating these substances with respect, and are we kind of replacing other forms of, you know, order and insight with them, and are we doing that naively? So there's going to be lots of things we discuss with John and with all the other guests I'm going to get on. But I want to start off with John because he's someone I highly respect, that we've had brilliant conversations with in the past about all sorts of philosophical ideas. And I think this just fits the mold very well. So I guess to kick this off, you know, maybe can you explain to me, in your mind, like what are psychedelics to you? Like, how do you envision them? What are they?
I suppose most fundamentally, they're just another means of exploring yourself. I mean, my curiosity has always been, well, about the world, but I don't, you know, you can't really separate yourself from the world. So my curiosity has always been probably more so internal than it has been external. And you explore the external world also almost as a means of contextualizing your explorations of the internal world. You know, like I did a lot of, well, I'll frame it in terms of perhaps my history. Like I went to South America on two different occasions for 3 or 4 months when I was 21 and 22. And they were both in order to go into the Amazon and learn about ayahuasca shamanism, basically. And, but among that trip, like I went to Machu Picchu and I went to Nazca and I went to Ollantaytambo and I went to Cuzco and I went to all these places where, you know, humans had done, you know, interesting or mysterious things in the past. And I want to do that because I want to understand not just myself, or rather understanding myself, I need to also understand other people, and I need to understand how other people acted, and I need to understand how other people acted in different places, in different times, and for what reasons, you know, and the meaning behind it all. Because it's all obviously wrapped up together, right? I mean, you and I are no different fundamentally from the people that lived in Machu Picchu, but they had a different perspective. They had a different framework of value and meaning. And I wanted to explore what that might be so that I can help determine what the most, what the optimal framework of value and meaning would be for myself. And that's like a never-ending process. And psychedelics are just another means of doing that. I don't want to say just another, because I think they're one of the, a very powerful means of doing that. But fundamentally, I think they just deliver to you a different perspective, another perspective by which you can see and investigate and explore yourself and what the relationship you have, you know, to yourself and to the world. And by whatever, you know, method of action it works, you know, the psychopharmacology behind it is kind of, it's interesting, but it's boring at the same time, because we don't really care the mechanics behind it. We just want to, it's the experience that's interesting and fascinating to us. And it seems to be the case that pretty much every culture and civilization that we have, you know, any sort of record of, so going back, let's say, 10,000 years ago, had ways of perturbing their consciousness in some way, shape, or form. Now, for a lot of them, the most expedient route seemed to be psychoactive substances. Psychedelic mushrooms were available in many different parts of the world, but of course, there was other kinds of psychoactive substances that were used. But in other places, it was ordeals. So either pain or poisons, mm-hmm. or things of that nature that really kind of broke you out of your day-to-day perspective and delivered you to a different place as a result of how difficult that, you know, circumstance was. Rhythmic dancing, you know, fasting, anything to, you know, kind of break the bonds of just your daily habitual thinking, you know, and your default mode network, as they call it in, you know, in psychology or in brain studies. And so they, you know, every civilization, or not, I shouldn't say every, but many, and certainly the most developed ones seem to have some method of doing that, some method of introspecting, some tool that allowed for a more fruitful, or like to amplify your ability to introspect, let's say. Yoga is another one, right? I mean, there was just always something. And then in conjunction with that, it seems like a lot of the systems of faith or belief, you know, call them religions or whatever, a lot of them seem to emerge from something similar, some rudimentary form of shamanism, be it in China or in South America or in the Middle East or what have you. And that seems to have instigated started off the process of developing these systems of value and meaning and belief that ultimately flourished into religions. And this is kind of the assertion that Mirescu makes in his book, The Immortality Key, which I know you've read. And I, you know, that was a very meticulously researched book, but that theme emerges in a lot of places, that it kind of started as individuals exploring deep within themselves to try to get a perspective that was different from the one that allowed them to hunt and farm and fuck and all these things, right? It was outside of that, but it was valuable to explore that because that allowed them to bring something back into that day-to-day waking consciousness that made life more meaningful, that allowed them to succeed or optimize life in some way and orient themselves most properly. And so to bring it back to my own experience, my a big part of my curiosity and my motivation in life generally, like the thing that's inspired all these curiosities and travels and experiences, has been to find that line of best fit, right? Like, what is the most optimal orientation to have as a human being on earth at this place and time? And, you know, I don't have a simple answer to that question, but it seems like the process has been a tremendous amount of introspection and then taking whatever is found there that seems to be valid, testing it, like integrating it into yourself, executing it in the world in order to test its validity, and then keeping what works, discarding what doesn't, and going back to the well intermittently to see if there's anything else there. And so to answer your question, psychedelics to me have just been a very powerful and useful tool to do that.
So a couple of things, just to clarify, I actually haven't read Immortality Key yet. It's on my list of
things to read. I thought I saw you tweet about it or something.
No, that wouldn't have been me. No, that would have been someone else. Maybe someone subtweeting me read it. Yeah, who knows? But I think, is that the one where the guy makes the claim that basically Christianity is sort of a result of, you know, early shamans basically taking mushrooms and...
It's centered around looking at Eleusis. So the Eleusis was kind of like the center of Greek, ancient Greek religion. And it was like these very exclusive rites that the best and brightest and most powerful of that era would have once in their life. And many would describe it as the most meaningful, profound experience of their lives and something that kind of helped uphold and revivify the ancient Greek culture more so than anything else. And he looked at kind of the history of it, so that it had been established for a very long time, even in advance of classical Greek civilization. And that when classical Greek civilization was in decline, the stewards of, let's say, that system kind of branched out throughout the Mediterranean. And so some wound up in Italy, some wound up in Spain, some wound up in France, et cetera, and kind of carried on these rites. And his thesis in the book is that the Dionysian sort of cult that prevailed at the time in Greece kind of morphed into the Jesus and Christian, you know, tradition and religion as it moved into Italy and developed initially underground and then obviously became the dominant system of faith, you know, in the third or fourth century.
So I've seen people, particularly Christians, sort of push back on that and say that's just, you know, bullshit propaganda written by, you know, mushroom hippies that want to find a reason to justify getting high, basically. Mm. And I mean, I need to sort of do my own analysis here, but I mean, I guess what I want to ask you.
I think it's like, worth noting, if I can just jump in, that Marescu is not that type of person. Like, he admits at the beginning that he's never tried any of these substances. He's purely like a theological and historical researcher, basically. And, you know, I just gave a very brief synopsis. It's a very meticulously researched and cited book. And he is exploring the continuation of the Eleusinian mysteries. And we have to also recognize that the Eleusinian mysteries, we don't know what it was that was facilitating those experiences. We're speculating, and he speculates in the book based on, like, you know, residues of certain cups and, you know, plant matter and this kind of stuff, that it was a psychoactive substance. And it seems like part of the ritual was that they would drink something and have these experiences. So, you know, it's not too far of a stretch to make that speculation, but we don't know for sure. It's not written down anywhere. We don't have records of it. It was highly secretive. And then the second thing is apart from that exploration, he does focus a lot on just the evidence, not even necessarily of the drug aspect of it, but how the association with Dionysus of the Eleusinian period and place, kind of the Dionysus part got carried over and was, you know, underground Rome developing. And he does, I don't want to say it's convincing, but he focuses in on how Dionysus and Jesus were kind of used interchangeably. And he makes a strong case that characteristics and such associated with the former were, you know, kind of transplanted onto the latter. Not necessarily just the drug stuff, so-called, but that, you know, and this should come as no surprise, right? I don't know if you've ever read much of Mircea Eliade's work, and particularly the history of religious ideas, but, you know, the development of systems of faith, religion, if you want to call them that, ideas, archetypes, all this kind of stuff, myth, they develop in a certain place and time. And then places that are, you know, adjacent to those cultures, they obviously, you know, they take some of that. You know, culture mm-hmm. is always a mishmash of things that are happening in areas that are influential to one another. And this is kind of just par for the course since time immemorial, right? These systems of faith and belief and myth, they develop, and then they are used for a period of time, and then maybe they go out of favor, but they're revivified in a certain way, and they're refined, and then maybe the sophistication isn't, you know, there's more a more sophisticated articulation of them or something. But there's a lot of very, very similar themes throughout them all, you know. So I think history is the process of kind of smashing these all together and then seeing ones that emerge in a more refined form than their prior ones. Not always in a more refined form, but, you know, directionally, perhaps that's true. And so all that just to say, I don't think Mirescu had a particular desire to kind of say like Christianity was based on a mushroom cult, but I mm-hmm. think he just explores and researches if there's any validity to a claim like that. And again, I mean, it's compelling. I don't know if it's conclusive, but it's compelling.
I was under the impression Dionysus was the was like the god of pleasure and wine and stuff like that. So kind of like almost like gluttony. I'm trying to figure out what the relationship there is to Jesus, because it sounds like two very different people.
I would butcher it, so I have to refer to the book. But I think just mm-hmm. a general comment is that like our understanding of whether it's the Greek gods or Roman gods or, you know, we tend to have like a simplistic association with certain attributes of these gods, and we lack the proper cultural context, like how they were seen in the culture. And so mm-hmm. I know through my investigation of which has been very limited to this point of those cultures and those systems of faith, they're far more, it seems like the cultures in which they operated, like in which they were the dominant system of belief, let's say, or meaning, ascribed much more meaning to those individual characters than just, you know, what's come down to us, like Aphrodite is the goddess of love and Dionysus is the goddess of debauchery and drinking and that kind of stuff. I think that's just too simplistic, right? No system of faith would have been successful and been so sticky, right? Been able to prevail for so long if it was just like simplistic like that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that makes me, I guess there's a few questions here. We've spoken about, you know, polytheism and monotheism when we spoke about your piece, Money Messiah, right? Mm-hmm. And like, is the move to monotheism and something like Christianity an evolution of this kind of mishmash of different, you know, gods? Like, so is that progress in a sense? And if so, you know, does that say something about like moving on from achieving so-called enlightenment or introspection or whatever through substances versus doing it through, which is, I guess, where, you know, you look at sort of the OGs of Christianity, like the St. Augustines and things like that, like they were the ascetics, like through fasting, faith, and deprivation, they came to, you know, these higher insights. And, you know, arguably, I guess the idea is that they didn't use any substances or shortcuts or anything like that. They did it purely. And that's part of, you know, the purity of something like Christianity over using these crutches, kind of like almost shortcuts to wisdom or unearned wisdom. Like, so I guess there's two parts to this question. Is like, you know, is that progression towards monotheism and in particular Christianity, for example, an example of progress which maps toward, you know, humanity moving away from the usage of these substances for enlightenment? And number two is, you know, are these substances potentially, do they, you know, with regular usage or with open usage, do they become shortcuts to kind of unearned wisdom versus, you know, these other methods that seem to be espoused in early Christianity, in particular, like asceticism, fasting, faith, etc. So what's your thoughts around that?
Yeah, they're great questions. My first, the thing that comes to my mind first is that I consider all these things like fasting and exercise and good diet and psychedelics and meditation and, you know, religious worship and all these kind of things. My perspective on this, so you asked me what psychedelics were before. I mean, I could have more easily summed it up and said, I think all of these are what I call clarity practices, attempts to gain greater clarity of perception. And I suppose, you know, almost an art, you know, my faith in that, or the reason why I engage in that or see it that way, is because perhaps I have a faith that if I can see clearly, I will see the truth, or I'll have a better chance at seeing truth. And I guess there's a value judgment there that, well, the truth is something valuable to perceive, right? Right? For what it instills in you, or what it inspires in you, or what it reveals to you, or how it motivates you. And I, you know, I do believe that. I think I do believe that, you know? And so I don't see psychedelics as an unnatural crutch or an easy way or anything like that. I mean, I think we evolved with these substances over millions of years. And I think there's clearly a reason why our brains react the way they do to them. I don't think it's a intoxication in the sense that most people are familiar with today, as in the case with alcohol, where that's the opposite of a clarity practice, in my opinion. You're stupefied, you're numbed, you're dialed down, you're not dialed up, right? Noise is injected into your perception with an intoxication with something like alcohol. I think, you know, for whatever reason, you know, that we evolved with them in this way, I think they deliver to me, like, in the apex of that experience, once you get past the, you know, the visual and auditory distortions and things like that, what I'm delivered to is a state of pristine clarity. And it's there that I feel I'm able to access more insights about myself and things that are more fundamental about myself, you know. And we'll touch on this a bit later, I'm sure, but it allows me to see past the aspects of my ego, right? It allows me to see past my insecurities, allows me to see past my ambitions, all those things that I associate with me, and allows me to see a clarity beyond that. And so I don't see it as a crutch. And also, I don't really buy into the undeserved wisdom thing either, because I don't think just by virtue of taking these things, you're delivered wisdom. I think you're only delivered wisdom by taking them if you earn it in the experience. So for an example, some people that take psychedelics, even if they take them in the proper context, right, the set and the setting, and they take the right amount, they can have a bad experience, a so-called bad trip. And I think what that amounts to is just a rejection of what's required of you and your consciousness in that moment to access that clarity and the wisdom that follows afterwards. And so, like, I don't think it's free, because I don't think you're getting it if it's unearned. It's because these experiences can be very challenging. I mean, most of mine have been. It's not just all, you know, there's so many cliches around psychedelics, and it's portrayed in such cliche ways in pop culture. But, you know, it's not all rainbows and, you know, light and all that kind of jazz. Like, it, for me, totally. Yeah. I need to walk through, it's a baptism by fire, basically. I need to push through all the things about myself that I don't like, that I'm hanging on to, that I have to confront the crutches that I'm using in my day-to-day perception and my day-to-day ego. And I need to figure out a way to transcend and let go of them so I can get to a place that seems more fundamental, more clear. And
sorry to interject there, but is there a presupposition there that, you know, you're not doing that in a sober fashion? Like, you need some sort of external substance in order to do that with yourself. Otherwise, you're just a dumb brute who's living on ego.
Well, again, I think there's a distinction to be made with all the ways we engage and explore our consciousness. For example, mm-hmm. I mean, you could easily just distill it down and say, what's the difference of perturbing consciousness through fasting, dancing, prayer, or ingesting a substance? At the end of the day, I mean, does it matter if the route of administration is past your lips and into your stomach, or if it's, you know, by virtue of pressure on your feet, by virtue of pain on your arm, by virtue of discipline in your mind? The punchline is that you're altering your brain chemistry to enable you to have access to an atypical or an abnormal sort of experience. And it's that experience that you seek because there's something of value in there that you can bring back to your default, you know, method of perception. So again, like I don't see it as a shortcut. And what I was saying is like part of the reason why I don't see it as a shortcut, because I don't see it as an easy thing. Like shortcuts, generally you think like that makes things easier, right? Like I'm going to take the short route and get there faster with less work and it's more efficient and all that kind of stuff. But I think the reason why I continue to integrate psychedelics into my development is because they're very efficient and they're very reliable at delivering me to the challenge that I'm seeking. Not to avoid the challenge, but just that they're an efficient way of, you know, basically, if I can use a metaphor for something I'm interested in, getting me to the cage, you know, getting me to the octagon. They don't do the fight for me. They just, you know, close the door behind me, basically. And so I don't see them as a crutch or a shortcut. I see them as a very efficient means of putting you in a position where you can meet that challenge and where you can. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to you whether you do meet it and you gain the value that's latent there, or you don't, you reject it, or you don't get as much value as you might. And again, like these things are we're dealing with such powerful things, not just in the sense of these substances and these experiences, but obviously our own minds, right? Like we're constantly navigating how to think about things, how to feel about things, how to control our emotions, what kind of meaning and value to ascribe to things. And so, as you alluded to earlier, there are many ways that you can misinterpret this experience and you can integrate it in a way that maybe isn't optimal. If we, you know, again, I don't even know what an optimal orientation to the world is. I mean, I think that's part of what these conversations are about, is trying to triangulate on that. But many people have these experiences, and I think many people consider them extremely valuable and extremely interesting and fascinating and insightful and worthwhile. But when you come back, you know, this is kind of a cliche too in the psychedelic world, is like integration is a big part of the process. And if you don't integrate that experience properly, if you don't place it in the proper framework, if it's more disintegrating than it is integrating, then you're probably going to have problems, and it may even end up being a negative influence in your life, you know, which is why it's so unfortunate that up till this point and even now, these experiences, which should be, in my opinion, done with the utmost care and preparation and consideration and with the help of others who have been there before, is illegal in most places and therefore has to be done underground and therefore can't necessarily be given the thoughtfulness and the attention and the care that it otherwise would have, and or the ritual and the you know, the all the different structures that we would want to see encompass an experience like this. And again, I think that's what Eleusis was, right? So you had this tremendously powerful transformational experience, but you also had a lot of, you know, ritual and other practices around it to help channel it into the proper, like to help people integrate it properly and optimally, rather than just, you know, having someone have an experience and then sending them packing, right? You know, all these places, all these retreats and stuff, whether they're in like Amsterdam or in the Amazon or what have you, people come down, they have these tremendously powerful experiences. And then 3 days later, they're back in their normal job and their cubicle and that's it. And again, they can still be very beneficial, but I think these things deserve a lot more context and assistance with integration, and we're lacking that today. But I think integration is a big part of it.
I think that piece I definitely agree with. In fact, I would say that these experiences are a net negative when you don't have the space for integration. And that's why I think a lot of the people, particularly Westerners that I've met who are, you know, advocates of psychedelics, you're actually honestly an exception, but most people that I know who are pro psychedelics are usually more anxious, more uncertain, more kind of like sort of liberally accepting of weird shit. Like I actually see more damage done with this shit than I see good. But before I get into that, I wanted to ask, I wanted to make one comment. You mentioned before about going to the octagon and it sort of closes the door behind you. I guess using that metaphor, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, obviously, you know, I guess isn't by the substance closing the door for you, you know, does that deprive you of, you know, the, in some way, the necessity to have the courage or the discipline to close the door for yourself? You know, and I think there is an argument to be made there, is that, you know, I know people, for example, they're like, fuck, I need to make a decision. And I'm sure you know people like this. I need to make a decision. I don't know what the fuck to do. I need to go do a trip this weekend, you know, and they go and pump some mushrooms. And they think that that's sort of the pathway to clarity. And maybe they find some clarity. But to be honest, you know, I don't know if they actually get clarity out of that. Or whether, you know, as Alan Watts would say, is like, you don't actually know where your decision came from. It just fucking spontaneously popped up and you can rationalize it all you want backwards. But, you know, the decision was actually spontaneous. So it's, you know, I don't know if we just kind of think that the psychedelics have given us clarity and we've all fallen for the, you know, Michael Pollan, Tim Ferriss pitch that what's going on is actually of benefit versus these experiences feel interesting, the extra sensory perception, like all this sort of stuff. And the novelty of it makes us perceive that there is actually something profound going on when in reality it's not. And then inadvertently we've created a crutch because we can't seem to find clarity in a sober state. We must think that we get fake clarity. We must think that we're getting clarity by using these substances when inadvertently we're not. So I think there is, you know, serious case to be made there, and particularly for, you know, Westerners who are doing the whole travel down to Machu Picchu, get high, go back to work, and, you know, do it every 3 months, for example.
Yeah. So, I mean, perhaps the MMA metaphor is not perfectly apt, but if I can butcher it finally to death here, perhaps the better way to frame it is that perhaps the mushrooms or the psychedelic experience is the opponent, not the door closing behind you. And because when you fight someone, you learn so much about yourself. How far can you push? How much heart do you have? Where's your skill at? Where's your strength at? Where's your endurance at? And you need that counterbalance or counterforce to help discover and refine yourself. In
measure.
That way.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. But again, I'll leave that metaphor for now and just having made that slight change. But I think, look, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. And I think, I mean, one of the things speaks to the desperation that so many people feel in this, you know, crazy clown world that we're in right now is that, you know, people will say like, well, fuck it. Maybe it's not the right way to go about it, but a week in the jungle to just, you know, blast out of my consciousness and see what else is around and then come back and get in my cubicle. I mean, it's almost a desperation play in a lot of places for a lot of people, I think, because a lot of people are very desperate. And so, you know, whether you wind up with alcoholism or endless, you know, partying and drugs, or whether it's Netflix and shitty food, or whether it's, you know, there's so many different ways that people handle this desperation. And, you know, I think we maybe have to recognize that at least those people that are taking, you know, the ayahuasca journey route, perhaps they're at least trying to do something beneficial about it, even if they don't know what, even if not in the proper way. Because I think we certainly say that the unconscious way to deal with, you know, that despair that permeates so many people is in those unhealthy, like, drugs, alcohol, eating, binge watching Netflix, and just, you know, basically living a shitty life. But just to finish off that, the point of your question is, I think people's approach is definitely overly simplistic, but, and I don't think you should just listen to Tim Ferriss or Michael Pollan and then, you know, decide what you think about these things. Like, I've been exploring this space for 20 years. And by exploring, I mean like reading, researching, having these experiences, multiple places, multiple times, multiple substances, all that kind of stuff. And for me, there's not really a distinction between that and the other things I do. They're just a matter of, almost a matter of intensity, right? Like the same reason that before this call today, I went and had a run on the beach and a swim in the water, and I only had fat and protein for breakfast. And, you know, like all those things are trying to put me in a place where I'm thinking and speaking as clearly as I can. And the practice, the far less frequent practice of psychedelic experiences, which is like, you know, at a maximum, especially at this point, like once a year, is just to do that, but in another domain, on another level, and to clear out. Well, because it gives me a capacity to do that, but on a deeper level, it seems. So I'm, you know, my daily routines and stuff is to try to, you know, clear out the noise of my brain and help me focus and stuff. But those experiences help me get to a level that I'm not able to on a daily basis. And
yeah,
I don't, and I don't think fasting or dancing or prayer is really much different. I think, you know, the experiences they deliver can be different, but I'm receptive to the notion that people can meditate for 8 hours or fast for 3 days and have a quasi psychedelic experience. I mean, or even these, you know, even spontaneous mystical experiences. And what's really interesting is that spontaneous mystical experiences seem to be able to be brought on by, you know, a tremendous devotion to a particular faith, let's say in Christianity, but they also, and I don't know if we want to crack open this nut on this podcast, but it seems like, you know, they're starting to happen in relation to Bitcoin. And it begs the question, like, what is a spontaneous religious experience? Like where the aperture just kind of opens up more than normal, and maybe you're flooded with insight or clarity that you're almost unable to handle, and that it's overwhelming in that sense. Is that what a mystical experience is? I mean, we don't have definitive language for articulating or describing what these things are. But again, suffice it to say that I think I don't see a huge difference between all of these practices. I just see it's about efficiency and reliability of putting you in the place where you can do the work, not abdicating the work. And I think the proof is in the pudding. And so to your point, like when people engage in these things and they're worse off, I don't think it's the substance or the method's fault. I think it's a matter of their approach to it, their capacity and dedication of the integration that follows, and all that other framework stuff we were talking about. But I think there is tremendous value in being able to be delivered to those states of consciousness, because when you're there, you can push so much further than you normally can. But there's a, you know, it requires thoughtfulness and experience and wisdom to actually know what to do with that afterwards, and to integrate it into the type of person that you're striving to be, right? Someone with an optimal orientation to the world and to whatever it is they're striving to achieve, to increase the fitness of what they are in relation to what they're striving to achieve or become. And again, unfortunately, I don't think there's sufficient context that, well, I don't think people are approaching it in that way. And so that may be the reason why we see suboptimal outcomes a lot of the time.
Thank you for saying the word apertures, because that's in one of the things that I want to discuss in a minute. So a couple comments there. I think a lot of these people who you mentioned, you know, you've got people who are stuck with the crazy clown world and they want to escape, and, you know, going and doing a retreat, ayahuasca retreat, is probably better than doing, you know, becoming an alcoholic. But I think honestly, a lot of those people, do you know what they fucking need? They need Jesus and probably a church and a fucking slap in the face. honestly. And this is actually coming from someone who, you know, I'm actually not, I can't even, still can't consider myself really a Christian in the religious sense. You know, I grew up Orthodox. I became fucking wildly atheist in my early 20s to mid 20s. And it's sort of been, the older I've become, the more I've, you know, respected Christianity and things like that. But I'm still, you know, you're not talking to Jimmy Song, right? You know, you're talking to me who likes to question these things. But I think a lot of these people, that's effectively what they need. They don't need another fucking ayahuasca trip. They need church on Sunday. And they need
discipline.
Fucking Bible. Yeah, discipline, right? And I think, you know, that this is sort of like a function of modernity. Like I'm reading a book now called The Handbook of Traditional Living, which is fucking like, if there was ever a book that was based, like this book is fucking based. I'll have to send it to you. It's really short. It's like a 90 page read, but holy fuck, I don't think I've ever read something as based as this shit. And it basically makes mockery of modern civilization in relation to, you know, the strength, grandeur, aesthetic, and just basically supremacy of ancient tradition. And they kind of say that they make a point in there that, you know, we've been conned to believe that, you know, human civilization is this sort of progressive march forward, when in fact it's actually a cyclical process where, you know, there was a golden age, then there was a bronze age, then there was an iron age, and now we're in the final dark ages in modernity, where, you know, everyone's awesome. Weak and we are surrounded by the masses, basically. It's quite dark, right? But yeah. You know, I guess the premise there is that, you know, a golden age will once again emerge from the ashes of the shit show that we're in. And I mean, if looking around at the clown world says anything, you know, maybe there is some wisdom here in this book. But anyway, for those listening, it's called A Handbook of Tradition. And there is no actual author. It's written by an organization called, I think it's Raido, R-A-I-D-O. So you should check it out. But yeah, I wanted to say, basically I wanted to say, the next question I wanted to throw at you is like, we talk about, you know, well, you mentioned these substances, you know, basically create an altered state, obvious fuckingly, you know, there's no denying that. And, you know, you're able to get, you know, some might call it deeper insights, you know, I might call it different insights, you know, whether they're deeper or not, I don't know, because I guess only time will tell.
Well, what is deep also? I mean, that...
Correct. Yeah. It's a matter of perspective. So that's, you know, questionable, but my cost here is my question here, I'm losing it in the question. What is the cost of using these substances, and cost at both the micro and the macro level? So when you take a substance such as this, and even something like weed, and I know from my experience with weed, like I didn't touch, the first time I ever tried weed was when I was 30. So I have a major sensitivity to it, right? Like you give me a milligram or two of the shit and I'm fucking on the moon somewhere.
Yeah.
And what I've discovered in, you know, trying this thing over and over again, and, you know, obviously also with mushrooms to a larger degree, is that it enhances or it increases that magic word you said earlier, the apertures. You know, you hear more, you see more, you smell more, you taste more, you know, touch is enhanced. Like all of these things are enhanced. And I think probably the big one is that time is dilated. And I think there's something deep and unknown about life and time and what time is. Like we try and measure it from an empirical science perspective, but we still don't have any fucking clue what this time thing is. And taking a psychedelic, even a mild one like weed, you know, or a heavy one like mushrooms or LSD or whatever, it actually fucks with time. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question to you is like, what is the cost of doing something like that? Because the brain and time seem to have some relationship that we have no fucking clue what it is. And what is the cost? Do you think there is a cost to that? And what, if so, what do you think that cost might be?
Just to clarify, a cost to that kind of open aperture state, or a cost to
totally
how these experiences impact you subsequently?
Both. So the cost, yeah, during the open aperture state, and then down the track, what it might do.
Well, first, you're just to comment on your comment about weed. Like, I'm the opposite to you. Like, I smoked weed when I was 14, 15, 16. And always in, I always I wanted to make sure I didn't feel guilty about it. So when I would smoke weed, it would be after my homework, my workout, like my chores, whatever I needed to do was done. And basically I was just going to kick it on my own or kick it with my girlfriend, like down in the basement anyways. Right. So like for me, it was amplifying relaxation. And as you said, like, you know, there would be food, there would be fucking, there would be candy, whatever. Like it just makes all that, all that stuff better. And that's how I treated it at the time. But I mean, I stopped smoking weed. Well, like probably 20 years ago now, or almost. And not like occasionally, like if it's going around and the situation is right, I might have some, but it's certainly not a regular thing. And that's because I find it now to be a noise introducing activity, not a clarity introducing activity. And again, my primary thing is fostering clarity. And, you know, there's a very interesting, I mean, I think that's one of the more interesting questions here. It's like, why? What is so compelling about seeing the truth of things? That's like, and I think part of the answer to that is because the more you can see, and again, defining truth is obviously very difficult, but the more you can see the most true thing, or like the highest fidelity relationship you can have to what is, then the better position you're in to adapt to whatever your aims are in relation to that thing, right? Because you're dealing with the most reliable data in interfacing with reality and interfacing with what's of value and meaning to you and the things you want to achieve or become. And so like that in itself is kind of an element of faith. And so the only time I use weed today is if I'm particularly stuck on an idea or something. And I literally will have a few puffs to try to see it from a different angle and see if that delivers any insights that I can then scribble down and come back to later. But even that is extremely rare. So just sharing my own particular practice with that. But in terms of dangers of increasing the aperture, physiologically, and I know this is not necessarily where you were going with it, but just to say,
not even dangers. Let me just clarify, like cost, because, you know, some, you know, costs don't have to be bad, but anyway, yeah, just cost, but yeah, you can say dangers anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting distinction. So physiologically, you know, for things like, psilocybin mushrooms, no. Cost, good distinction, because there's a cost to everything. You know, every action you take, there's a cost, living cost, right? At this conversation right now, we're spending our time and our energy. And so we're always determining, that's how we determine value, right? That we spend the resources that we have in order to have those experiences. And we value them in doing so. And so sure, there's a cost, but as you say, is the cost worth it? And I would say that's entirely dependent on the experience you have and the outcome. And I guess this is why it's so, you know, the conversation we've had thus far, these elements, being in the right mindset and approaching these things properly and contextualizing them properly and integrating them properly is so important to making sure that the cost is worth it. So, sorry, what was the second part of the cost question?
Sorry, I had myself muted. The first part was like, you know, what is the cost of opening up the apertures, right? And the second the second part of that is like the downstream cost of, you know, the effects that such substances have on people. Like, does it actually change them? And does it change them actually in a strange way that has maybe given way to the clown world that we're in? And basically what I'm pointing to there is kind of like the 60s fucking hippie revolution, right?
Yeah. It's tough, right? Because who's in the proper position to be final arbiter of these things, of individual, of moral, of cultural judgments, right? Like, I know you and I would probably assess things quite similarly, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're right. And, you know, I could think of, sometimes I encounter this stereotypical, like, psychedelically awakened person, let's just say. And I'm like, God, like, you know, another one of these people sort of thing. So obviously by virtue of having that response, I probably wouldn't want to replicate that individual across the whole world. And in terms of thinking, like, is this, if this person were replicated, would it produce, you know, a better world, a less clowny world? And, you know, maybe less clowny, that's entirely possible because we're pretty fucking clowny right now. But is it an optimal way for an individual to be, and as part both as an individual and as part of a flourishing culture, let's say, in its current incarnation and the way it's currently treated and how it's currently impacting people? Perhaps not. Like, I do think it's true that a lot of times when people have this sort of quintessential psychedelic experience, they do become more empathetic. They do become more compassionate. But those things can get out of control very easily. And you can have too much empathy and you can have too much compassion, and you can be not rigid enough such that, you know, you're barely, like, what order is it that you're a part of fostering by your own individual behavior? I mean, that's really the question you're asking, right? Like,
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think we're suffering in a world of excessive liberalism and zero conservatism. And I don't say that in the political sense. I mean that in the behavioral sense, is that we've thrown conservatism to the wind and we've basically embraced... There's three words that come to mind: liberalism, acceptance, and relativism. And they're generally things that occur. I feel it in myself when I've done psychedelic experience. I'm way more accepting. I'm way more liberal and open. And I am, you know, way more like, you know, you fall into a far more relative state. And these things are, I guess, contrary to order. Now, obviously, in the world, we require both. We need order. And we need, you know, within the framework of order, we need some sort of, you know, liberalism and relativism and acceptance. But I mean, I think, you know, this is going to be a stretch, but, you know, could the 60s hippie revolution have been what made way for the participation award at public schools, which made way for transgenderism, you know what I mean? And, you know, feeding kids fucking, hormones so that they can choose what gender they are. Like, one could argue it's a tenuous link, but I actually think there is truth in those kind of linkages.
I agree. I don't know if, I mean, the hippie revolution was a very interesting phenomenon with, I'm sure, a lot of obvious and not so obvious downstream effects. But I think the whole, like, if you're suggesting that there's kind of an over-indexing for liberal attitudes and perspectives, I think it was well underway prior to that. And, you know, you could, I think there's a fairly, I think you could make an interesting case that this so-called death of God could have been very influential in that process, because as we've kind of been dancing around here, whatever the validity of any particular faith is, it's most often true that it is a discernible, articulated faith. And that necessitates a kind of discipline, as we were alluding to earlier, because that's what it's about. Like, you are disciplined in relation to this thing, or you are not. And that is kind of the measure of faith almost. And when you remove the faith, you also remove the discipline that came along with it. And, you know, I think, you know, it's very interesting that I know you're super familiar with Peterson's work as well, but so often it comes back to this thing where you almost have these two primordial forces, right? The chaos, which is destructive, but also potential, and order, which helps you push back the chaos, but can be stultifying and can become too rigid and become tyrannical. And that mediating force is, you know, is the regenerative hero, but it's also it's the answer to how do you mediate those things? Because on the one hand, you could say, okay, you get rid of whatever religion and that discipline goes away and everything becomes relative and people become too receptive and open and liberal, and anything and anyone can be anything and anyone. And there's just, where is the grounding truth? Where is the grounding discipline? And you could say that's bad. And, you know, in the context of the culture we have today, I would probably agree with you, but it is, it's almost like it's inevitable too, because it's always going to be that you over-index for one. There's too much chaos. Mm-hmm. The strong man comes mm-hmm. in, establishes order. There's too much order. The chaos encroaches to shake things up again. And mm-hmm. the most important component of those forces, and this is also why I think the Trinity is such a pervasive notion throughout many religions and systems of faith throughout history, is because you have those two forces, and then you have the thing that mediates most between them. If you want to call mm-hmm. it Christ, if you want to call it Logos, if you want to call it the Holy Spirit, if you want to call it, you know, the mythological hero, whatever. But, and that's the individual, in my opinion. That's the individual that must take it upon themselves to determine the proper balance between those two forces and to establish it in themselves initially, in their family, in their community, in their culture. And that is integration, right? That is integrating mm-hmm. all the mm-hmm. way from, you know, the spirit world or the whatever you want to call it, into the self and out into the culture. And so part of my investigations into, I don't want to be overly presumptuous and call it the spirit realm, so let's just call it these altered states of consciousness, is to foster that integration, you know, on every level of analysis. Because another one of the things that you mentioned is like acceptance, right? Like, is there too much acceptance of stuff? And the first thing that came to my mind was, I think there's a distinction to be made regarding the level of analysis that we're looking at here. Like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is there too much acceptance in the social realm? Let's use a current silly example, like with all this transgender stuff. Absolutely. Like, so much of this is preposterous, and you're not being compassionate to anyone by saying like a girl can be a guy and all this crazy shit that's going on. I mean, that's obviously acceptance gone way too far, accepting of these absurd mm-hmm. notions. But if you take it to a way higher level, do I accept my mortality? Do I accept my existence within a broader system, whether you want to call it the universe or God, that I don't understand, but that I am subordinate to no matter what I like? Well, those are both types of acceptance, but they're operating on different scales, let's say. And so mm-hmm. I think I've intentionally cultivated, and this has been a byproduct of my experiences, particularly in the psychedelic realm, where I have a greater acceptance on the higher scales, like whatever it is, that force that mediates these things, you know, and my own mortality, I have a much greater acceptance there. But when we bring that down to my individual day-to-day or social levels, I'm not saying that I'm looking to, you know, die early. I'm not saying that I'm willing to let someone impose, you know, their will upon me. I'm just saying that and I will push back tremendously on that. And on all these, political or economic or social issues that we've been referring to, like I don't accept many of them, and I seek solutions and alternatives to live my life in the way that I want without having to accept them or even rejecting them actively. But again, on a higher level, I have an acceptance of the system that I'm within. And so again, that point is, I only make that point so that we can distinguish, like when we're talking about a term like acceptance, like I happen to think that cultivating like profound, if I could use that somewhat vague term, mm-hmm. acceptance or peace around what and who I am is one thing, but not accepting, let me rephrase that. Not accepting, so peace and acceptance around the context in which I exist. I know that's also vague, but give me that one for a second. But also not accepting all the different ways in which I see myself as deficient, or I could be refined more in relation to the things that I value most or think are most meaningful. And so on the latter, I'm not accepting at all. Like I'm a brutal self-critic, and I take great measures to try to identify areas that could be refined or improved and to do so. So that's not an acceptance there, but on a higher level, there's an acceptance. So Does that make sense making the distinction when we're using this type of language?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I think it's a very important distinction because I think the issue there for me is that people who might, through these substances, for the first time in their lives, you know, when they've never had any time for introspection, when they've never actually taken any of that seriously, and they go and have this kind of an experience and they get a taste of this higher form of acceptance and they don't know what to do with it because they're not mature individuals yet. You know, they then let that feeling of acceptance just bleed into everything else. Then they're accepting of, hey, you know, like everyone is everything. You know, why can't we accept that, you know, biology doesn't exist? You know, why can't we accept that, you know, the patriarchy has been there to do that? So I think that comes back to, and I have a point on this. Trust me, I've thought about this from so many directions. Like, I'm not trying to trap you, but like there's, you know, there's so many parts that I want to sort of pull on this is that.
Well, trap me, man. I want you to, you know, let's get somewhere with this.
Thank you. like, this comes back to cost to me, that back up to the apertures thing, but then it also ties into the people who should is a weird word, but the people who should be trying this stuff versus the ones who shouldn't. And you know, at the risk of sounding elitist, there was a reason why the way what you mentioned in the Immortality Key, it was the elites that did this, you know, not the masses. And it was highly secretive for a specific reason, is that it isn't just a thing you just make very easily publicly accessible. It's something that should be very, very, very difficult to get a hold of for anyone, which as much as I disagree with making things illegal, because anyone should have the right to put whatever they want in their body. You know, maybe that illegality came downstream of a suppression of such a substance for the masses, because had the masses come into mass usage of such substances, which is effectively what happened in the 60s, people degenerate because they are not mature enough to use these substances. Now, once again, there is obviously exceptions to that rule. But by and large, I think 9 out of 10 people are not ready, not worthy, not in a position to use such substances. And the insight that they receive from it, they mistake for enlightenment, which is a first big fucking mistake, because insights are not enlightenment. And then secondarily, they then take those insights and they misapply them in their lives in the world. And then thirdly, I would also add to that, they actually think that they have the hubris to think that they have discovered truth through the mushroom, and they think they are somehow, you know, as modern man is morally superior to what those idiots wrote 2,000 years ago in stupid books like the Bible, for example. And you sort of get this weird kind of Silicon Valley-esque transhumanist view of, you know, we microdose our way into being superior humans, right? And fuck what those Midwesterners sort of say. You know, they're just dumb, Trump-loving weirdos. So anyway, I know I've gone off in a bunch of tangents there, like, you know, characterizing people, but I think there is, there's a few points here.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you want to pull on any.
I do. Yeah.
Elaborate. Okay.
I think, so remind me, I want to come back to this point you're making where you think a lot of people are kind of going off course with this, but just to go back for a moment and hopefully I don't forget our place, where we were saying about, you know, the whole death of God thing, right? Cause you were, and basically the point that I was trying to make there is like, yes, I think we've fallen into this relativism, this state of disarray in many cases. But I wonder, you know, because, and the reason why I brought up the chaos and order and the mediating force point is because I think that's an eternal cycle. And are we how much should we lament the current situation? And this kind of even ties into the other point we're making, versus accepting that we always kind of, it's this waxing and waning of order and disorder, and trying to find the mediating principle that allows us to maximally move forward. This, you know, two steps forward, one step back sort of thing. And so are we in a period where we're in that disarray, you know, or that iron age to your point earlier? And it's just, once again, it's calling upon individuals to integrate themselves sufficiently that they can become integrating forces for the world, you know, initially from themselves, their family, their community, and the world. And in doing so, rebalance those forces once again in a manifestation that's more sophisticated or more refined than has ever been the case in the past. And I, you know, if you're going to, Neumann, who wrote The Origins and History of Consciousness, I mean, he makes basically this point by investigating the development and the evolution of, let's say, representation, religious tradition, iconography, and that kind of stuff. And again, I'm going to way oversimplify, but his thesis is basically the iconography and religious imagery and religious ideas from time immemorial is basically, it represents, attempts to communicate both intentionally and I suppose unintentionally in different respects, the individuation of the human psyche. So almost reflecting our evolutionary journey from being highly collectively minded as, you know, as lesser evolved versions of human beings as we are now, and identifying more with, you know, our group or our tribe or what have you, and slowly, for a variety of reasons, becoming, having more individuated psyches and egos. And then as a result of that, having to embark on that perilous journey of becoming more individuated and not falling back into the collective, but also not falling too far into the individual ego, and finding that balance between the two where you have a, I can't remember the term he used, but it's something akin to like a, well, it's kind of like the hero archetype, ascending to that, ascending to someone who is fully integrated within themselves, grounded in truth, having integrated and identified, you know, all the virtues that are typically associated with these characters, and using them to foster or manifest the best possible good, something like that. And I think it's an interesting conversation. It's a worthwhile theory, perhaps, to suggest that this plays out through, you know, what we know as human history as well. And I think it's possible that we're in a period where of disintegration, where the old systems of order and discipline and meaning and value have failed to keep up, perhaps, with the development of the human mind or human thought or the size and scale of human civilization, something within that mix. And as a result, they've been cast aside because they're seemingly increasingly useless. They're not seen as being as valid, as useful as they were in the past. And that has created an unintentional chaos that has invited unintentionally, you know, too much entropy into the system, let's say. And that very action, you know, that very introduction, that very presence of a higher degree of chaos is motivating people to level up, to ascend to a higher capacity for understanding, for seeing and ascribing value, for seeing meaning and integrating it into their life and fostering it in the world. Like,
it seems to be doing two things there, though, right? It's like it's simultaneously creating that in very few people, and then at the same time, you know, creating the opposite, like I wrote a note. He's like, have we not fallen back into the collective? And are not these substances one of the things, you know, like abolishing the ego, dissolving differences, excessive acceptance? Like, it seems like there are some people, very few. And again, I would put you squarely in that category of like people who are taking the hero's journey as a result of, you know, having access to these, you know, whether it's these substances or these thinking or, you know, kind of the chaos that is inherent in the world, like heroes are rising. But for the large mass majority, they're just basically dissolving into, you know, the what Francis would call the sludge.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. But I think what I would say in response is just that the way I'm characterizing this, I think we're at the beginning of this emerging mm-hmm. from the sludge sort of thing. And so it's natural that mm-hmm. there would only be relatively few members amongst the total that are, you know, beginning to respond to the enhanced chaos in that way. And again, I don't mm-hmm. want to be too like, you know, self-aggrandizing or anything, but I would say that Bitcoiners and other, you know, other, certainly other groups of people around the world today, I mean, I think you see that they are changing themselves in certain ways in response to the chaos. And part of that, you know, you referenced the book you were just reading, is looking back and seeing, okay, what, you know, well-established traditions, what well-established methods of order, both individual and social, have we discarded haphazardly or irresponsibly or something like that? And can we bring them back to establish more order, to order once again, but with a sprinkle of something new? I mean, again, this is mm-hmm. the hero archetype. And I think this is the archetype that we all strive to embody, like to not just take what worked in the past. Okay, let's go back to, you know, the Amish, or let's go back to anything in the past, like the uber religious societies of the past. Like, that worked back then, let's just use it now. It's like, no, things are different now. The world is different. Human mind is different. Technology is different. I think it necessitates something new. But I think the mistake that's made collectively is that in our attempting to determine what new method of order most balances those eternal forces, we throw away too much of the past. And that the past is the order that repels the chaos, right? And so I think what we're doing now is looking back once again and saying, we discarded too much. We need to invite back the traditions of the past that worked. And then we have to use those traditions as a platform or a basis to look toward the future, knowing what we know about it and ourselves in the current landscape, and say, what needs to be added to this to optimize for reestablishing that balance between order and chaos, again, as individuals, as well as, you know, a society. And I think it's interesting that, and again, I'm speculating here, but perhaps it's the case that an idea like is represented in Christianity, the idea of Christ was so powerful in the time that it emerged, that it fostered that process, that it permitted that process. And, you know, there's a lot of critics, there's obviously a lot of supporters, but, you know, maybe there's a case to be made there. There's an interesting conversation. And I think we both agree that a thing that's emerged in our time, Bitcoin, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. is probably going to be something similar that allows mm-hmm. us to optimize the balance between those two things in a way that's never been optimized before. And so we're just in the time now where we're in, you know, the trough period, where we've thrown away too much of the past, invited in too much chaos, and haven't distilled the potential from that chaos and integrated into the traditions of the past to establish a greater form of order than has ever been established. But I do think that is the process that you and I and Bitcoiners and other people are participating in. And I do think that's also why there's such an impetus and focus on individual refinement and development within this mm-hmm. group of people that we interact with, because mm-hmm. there's a recognition, both conscious and subconscious, that that is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, yeah, that's,
And just to bring it back to your original question, because I do remember it this time, is like, should these things be reserved for the elite? Because, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that aren't ready to have their snow globe shaken up in that way. And it could be more disintegrating than integrating, let's say. And I'm with you. Like, I don't think anyone should tell anyone else what to put in their body. But again, I think this is something that is handled by culture, starting with the individual, starting with the family, starting with the virtues and the responsibilities and the ideas and the beliefs that a father and mother inculcate into their children, or mm-hmm. at least try to cultivate mm-hmm. in their children. And it grows out in the way that it should from there. And so that, you know, it's a similar thing with the gun thing, right? Do you just make guns illegal because guns kill people? No, you foster a sense of responsibility, a sense of respect, mm-hmm. there was a sense of its proper use and context and place and all of those things. And you can't just snap your fingers and make that happen. That's a long-term process of developing a culture, starting from the individual and going into the family and beyond from there, of understanding how to treat the things that are of the greatest power in our society. Mm-hmm. Guns mm-hmm. being one of them, well, psychedelics think, being another one.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Christianity seems to have done a good job of that over the centuries, because, you know, through culture and I guess through the church, it's, I mean, as far as I understand, it was a substance, and such substances were suppressed because of the way, I mean,
that's a tricky one, because to what extent do these institutions, which obviously became corrupt and obviously wanted to retain their power, wanted to cut people off from having maybe a direct experience with the divine rather than having it mediated through the institution of the church? I mean, that conversation needs to be had. And I think there's a lot of validity to that. So, and you know, as well as like, you know, I'm not the church and religion is stupid and only corrupt. Like there's so much, there's a reason why it was so sticky, right? There's so much value there. And mm-hmm. again, I think mm-hmm. modern society has discarded it with, you know, way too haphazardly, with far too much hubris and arrogance. But in respecting it in that way, I don't want to suggest that it wasn't itself susceptible to corruption and propagating that corruption and having it, the actions that it took as a result influence the culture, both good and bad. And I think in the sense of like burning people at the stake for, you know, being into herbs or, you know, being into psychedelics or whatever, I would say that was a misguided behavior. And I would say it was mostly a result of trying to retain, you know, power over people rather than really caring for their own relationship to spirituality, whatever that might mean.
Yeah. The later it went, the worse it got. I think there was a, you know, the original intent would have emerged from, you know, the ascetic kind of tradition and, you know, the more based early Christians, and, you know, the sort of idea that it was a hidden secret rite of passage. But then, you know, as it became institutionalized, much like the rest of religion, you know, that hidden secret component became, you know, more like a, yeah, as you said, like
carrot or something.
Yeah, it was kind of almost like a protection mechanism for the institution that wanted to maintain its dominance and chose to use kind of fear and force as a way to keep people from this. But yeah, this is where I think there was much, you know, wisdom probably, you know, if that book, Handbook of Tradition, you know, is true in any way. They say that, you know, much of the wisdom of the ancients was that those hierarchies were hierarchies of competence. And it's when, you know, the hierarchies became infected with things like acceptance of the everyman that they decayed and they became, you know, more flat in nature. And that's sort of what brings about, you know, the kind of the collapse of the order. And we move into, you know, what I would call a tyranny of the lowest common denominator, which is really, mm-hmm. you know, where we are today in the world. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. there is, I tweeted that funny meme a couple of hours ago of the, of that guy, you know, who's you kind of see, he's like the bushman, and he goes out, stabs the fucking pig in the head, blood everywhere. And then it's kind of like, yeah, the modern version of
this. Behind his wife or something. Yeah.
and the look on his fucking face is just so perfect, right?
But I think that's what Bitcoin over the course of time is going to fix. Can't be imposed on people, and it'll bring back a meritocratic hierarchy. And I think that's good. And that will help, again, foster that culture I was alluding to, where the way in which you or I might think that this, you know, these experiences should be cultivated or frameworked, let's say, I think will emerge as a result of that.
Yeah,
there won't be anyone policing it, but the culture will guide people to it in a more proper way, let's say.
Yes. And I think that more proper way, honestly, will be far more exclusive and elusive than how it's framed and positioned today. Right. Mm-hmm. That would be my guess. I could be wrong, but I actually think it's going to become a much more difficult rite of passage, and it will be looked like that. In healthy cultures, it'll be viewed as something that you don't just fuck around with this shit, bro, because you're fucking, you know, you're 21 and you think you're going to fucking discover truth. And, you know, you're smarter than, the thousands of years of tradition and history that came before you. Cause that's one of my, my big irks. Like I wrote something here while you were writing, while you were speaking earlier, and it was just, maybe I'll just ask it as a question to you. It was like, yeah. If the truth was spoken by God and written in a book like the Bible, is it not the height of hubris to seek truth via a substance? Are these not false gods? Did the Bible not warn against such false gods? So it's like it's a pointed question.
Well, they totally are. Is the only logical answer? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's an article of faith, basically, that they are. Mm-hmm. But again, the counterpoint to that would be who said, you know, who wrote the Bible? So certainly it wasn't God, right? It's supposedly God's word, but you know, the Bible was written a couple hundred years after the time of Jesus. So we know that men wrote the Bible, and we're taking it, you know, we're taking on their word or the word of many people, or again, we're taking it on faith that the revelation from which those words supposedly stem are true. But again, we can't know that for sure, which is part of the, I think that's, you know, that's the idea of faith. It's like, I'm going to hold this as true. And I think that's part of how truth emerges, because knowing that we can never truly really know things for certain, or at least certain, some things, you have to say, I'm going to act as though it's true. And then you see what the products of that action produce.
Yeah, that's Jordan's argument about God, right?
Right. And you say, oh, wow, taking these things on faith as true produces really good outcome. Maybe there's some deeper truth to them. Alternatively, you could say, wow, taking these things on faith as true produces really fucking shitty outcomes. Maybe they're false gods, right? Maybe they're not true. I think that's a very logical way to approach things. But again, the problem is that certainly, you know, devout Christians would say, you know, you're worshiping a false idol. The only truth is God. But unfortunately, and I think one of the reasons why, perhaps Christianity is losing adherence, if I can say that today, or at least in the Western world, is because that's just another faith assertion. Like, okay, you say I'm wrong because your God is right, but like, that's not a good great argument.
Yeah.
You're just saying it is the way it is because it is the way it is. And there's I need more logic and rationale than that to join you in that presupposition.
Yeah. I mean, sort of, I guess I would look at the kind of people who make the for and against point. Like these days, again, despite not being a devout Christian, I actually get along far better with Christians than I do with fucking psychedelic hippies. Like way fucking better. There's not even a fucking it's.
But I have a question. Yeah, like, for you. Do you think that's a result? Because not all Christians are the same, right? Like, how you interpret the idea of God, how you interpret the faith, how you interpret all the articles. I mean, all the different articles of faith. I mean, you could say that the only devout Christians are the ascetics, because the ascetics are the ones who are so fulfilled They are so sustained by their belief and their relationship in and with God that they require nothing else in life, because it the value of that relationship so supersedes everything else that they don't require anything else in their life. Is that the highest expression of faith? And if it is, are you a true Christian if you don't express it in that way? Who knows? But my point, and I agree with you, like I know lots of Christians, and obviously it's becoming kind of a theme with Bitcoiners, and I get along with them really well. And we have really stimulating conversations of this kind for that reason. But are they the way they are more of a result of humility and deference rather than, you know, a complete integration of every article of the faith that they supposedly are aligned with or espouse? Like, it's again, I hate to go back to Peterson all the time, but you know, a funny video came out recently where the animated dude was blowing people's heads off.
Yeah.
Like, do you believe in God?
Hilarious.
No, do you believe in God? No. Do you believe in God? Yeah. Well, what do you mean by God? What do you mean about belief? Like, and it seems like it's an easy question to answer, but it's obviously not once you get kind of fine grain with it. And I think that's the case with Christians. I don't think we should just assume that they're all living representations of the fundamental truth of the Christian ethic, and therefore
absolutely
treat them that way. But I only say that because it's certainly, I think, one of the hallmarks of any faith, but let's focus on Christianity here, is a true type of humility, because at a minimum you're recognizing that you are subordinate to a higher power, this, you know, God. And humility is one of those things, again, you can go too far with it, you can be too humble, but if it's properly contextualized, it invites friendship, it invites dialogue, it invites, you know, a mutual desire for understanding, it invites education, all these things. And so I guess I'm just saying, like, I never want to ascribe what I think about an idea or a faith to people that say they ascribe to that thing, because who knows how much our ideas about those things really line up. But to our prior point, we can look at a minimum, we can say they believe in something, and I'm observing their actions to be of a certain way. And that is definitely still meaningful, whether or not what they say they believe in, I interpret that thing the same way. We can say at least what they think they believe in is producing certain behaviors, and then we can judge those behaviors as however we like. And we say, yeah, it's producing seemingly positive behaviors. What does that mean? Does that validate some of the beliefs they hold? Probably it does. Okay, let's talk to them about how do they understand the beliefs they hold? Let's have that conversation. So,
I mean,
comment.
Yeah. I is there a question there? Look, I agree with what you said. And just a heads up, I've got 5 minutes before I've got to bounce.
Sure.
So we're definitely going to have to do a subsequent piece to this. But what I was referring to was, I guess, more a heuristic of the kind of person who is more prone to be an adherent of some form or variation of Christianity, whether it's like, you know, a Catholic or a Protestant or a Seventh-day Adventist, you know, I must say, at least from my perspective, there seems to be, you said there's like a dissolution in the West of like Christianity. There seems to me like a reemergence at the same time as a dissolution. And this to me seems to be like the separation. You've got this kind of like weird growing, you know, atheism, which seems to sit in the same bucket as this kind of weird modern day, you know, spirituality shit, right? That you kind of see floating around with, you know, I mean, the poster child of that kind of shit is Aubrey Marcus. Like, I'm not a big fan. And, you know, the kind of shit that sometimes comes out of his mouth is like, you know, vomit material. But, you know, and look, that's not to say that, you know, he hasn't been successful in his life. He's done some cool things. But, you know, when someone else is banging your girl, like, that's a, you know, something's wrong there. You know what I mean? So like you've got this kind of bifurcation. And for me, at least, once again, the older I get, the more conservative I become. And I seem to get along with people who are more conservative, and the kind of people who are more conservative generally seem to be converging on Christianity as an ideal. You know, whether it is the Jordan Petersons of the world or whatever, like there seems to be some sort of heuristic or rule of thumb or consensus around that.
In the West, though, right? I mean, in the environment you live in and you interact in, is that the case in China? Is that the case in India? Is that the case in other places?
Yeah, but I mean, you look at those civilizations and they're completely fucking broken, completely fucking upside down. And I don't know, like the... Like I just finished reading Shantaram with, I don't know if you've listened to that or read that
I've
yet.
I've heard of it. Haven't read it. No.
Fucking fantastic. But you look at the kind of squalor and fucking chaos and mess, as much as, you know, the author makes a good, you know, whatever his name is, GDR, Gregory David Roberts, he makes a good case for, you know, the beauty and the happiness and all that sort of stuff of the people. Like, again, this is going to sound elitist, but Western civilization, and it is superior, and it is specifically civilization. And like, because that is, you know, those regions lack civilization in a sense, and they are predated. Now, there's a much bigger argument, there's a much bigger discussion here to be had around, like, you know, I guess, should their civilization just be left alone to operate in their own? Because maybe it's the clash of Western civilization, which is one type of culture from one type of people, that superimposed against their form of living turns into, you know, the kind of chaos and shitstorm that they have going on there. But anyway, that's another thing. So to kind of finish my thought, it's like when I look at it, yeah, maybe to your point, the West. I see this kind of convergence of more conservative, ordered, structured, you know, family valuing, you know, people converging on Christianity, and then the kind of weirdos that seem to be converging on, and once again, there's exceptions to the norm on both, but the kind of people I see that are in the spiritual, so-called spiritual realm, they're all just like weak hippie weirdos, man. You know, they, you know, their whole idea is like, do some yoga, build a fucking altar in your room or in your living room, go and like breathe and pray to the fucking altar, you know, whatever gods you want to have, you know, take a mushroom trip every weekend, make sure you microdose because that's how you're going to fix yourself and all will be fine. And like, I've had, you know, traveling Europe, I told you how much of a pain it's been recently, but man, going through like and seeing some of the old churches like in Florence and stuff like that, and you think about like the level of like quality, like coming back to, you know, Robert Persig's book, you know, Metaphysics of Quality, like the quality of that altar in that fucking church that has stood 500 years or 1,000 years, like as a place of worship versus your cheap, shitty fucking hippie version in the corner of your living room, you know, that you built yourself from fucking shit at Home Depot. Like, motherfucker, you need church. You don't need another fucking mushroom trip. And anyway, this is a random rant. And I know that it doesn't qualify for everyone, but kind of my closing thoughts.
Sure. I'll give you my closing thoughts now in response to that. So one on the church thing, I totally agree. And it's amazing. You have to think, what could possibly have motivated people to bring to bear the sophistication that was available mathematically, architecturally, aesthetically at the time? Oftentimes in, you know, projects that spanned lifetimes, what could motivate people to put that much effort into glorifying an idea, you know, or if you want to say glorifying a person in Christ or glorifying an idea or a force in God? And, you know, again, the modern respond, you know, the modern people approach it, you know, atheists or secular people would go into a church and they'd feel the grandeur and they would be inspired by its beauty and all that kind of stuff. But then they would dismiss or not really consider, like, you have to understand, I mean, most people can appreciate in their own life, like, what inspires you to take on a great work, to devote yourself to something? It has to be tremendously meaningful. And to not account for that, I think, is a big mistake. And so what I wanted to say twofold about your comments. One, we'll have to get into it on the next call because, you know, places like where I lived in Shanghai and in China over the last several years, I mean, obviously the government is separate, but if you're an individual there, you feel, I mean, the society is safer. It's more technologically advanced. You have more at your fingertips. It's more convenient. So what measures, what metrics are we looking at to judge the refinement of a particular society? And then, you know, if you wanted to be really, you know, kind of cheeky about it, you could compare it with the state of San Francisco, of LA, of Portland, and these places, the outskirts of Paris, whatever. You know, so if we're suggesting that the proof is in the pudding, we have to be fair in saying, like, well, what's the pudding look like in from one place to another? But to the prior point you were making, that there seems to be this, at least in the Western world, this reemergence of the appreciation for, you know, the Christian faith, the idea of Christ, the wisdom contained therein. I agree with you, and I'm observing that myself. And I think this goes back to what we were saying before, in that it's entirely possible that we were too hasty, you know, as a society, as a civilization, to throw away things that worked in the past in favor of some false notion of progress or modernity or the future. I think that's entirely possible. The question in my mind is, when we bring the things that we're bringing back, which may include, you know, a greater emphasis once again on the nuclear family and on gender roles and on, you know, strength and faith and systems of religion, Christianity, what have you, what is it we should take back? What is it we should keep, you know, left over or discarded? And what is it about our state today, our state of mind, consciousness, development, evolution, that should be added or integrated into what we bring back to revivify it and bring it to the next level? So, like, I'm definitely receptive to the idea that the next 1,000 years end up being the continuation of the Christian era, let's say. I'm receptive to that. I just don't think, I think it's clear that we have to engage in that process once again of recognizing that we may have discarded something and being very thoughtful in why we discarded it and recognizing what we legitimately discarded and leaving it discarded, but also recognizing what we unintentionally or should not have discarded and bring it back, but add to it the things that make it suitable for the state of ourselves and the world as it is today, such that it can serve that unifying, integrative purpose, disciplining purpose that in certain places and times in the past it has served, but for whatever reason, it's failed to perform as well as it has in the past by in the current. And how do we revivify those things? And how do we add, you know, I've said this a couple times already. It's kind of like the Bruce Lee quote, right? You take what's useful, you discard what's not, you add what's uniquely your own. And this, again, that's kind of the archetype of the chaos order hero thing. And
yeah,
what emerges is potentially the thing of greatest value once again. And it's of greatest value because it most properly orients you to the truth. And that is borne out in what it manifests in terms of behavior and productions and creation in the individual and interpersonal world.
Yes. Beautiful statement. I will say that Shanghai is probably more Western than San Francisco.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, almost certainly.
Look, I think as much as there's like my list of things to discuss is, you know, endless here, but this has been a very, very, very good conversation as usual, buddy. I hope at the very least kind of challenges people on both sides to think this through further. Because there is, this is far deeper than I think what people, people on both sides might think. You know, so someone might say, oh, it's just a fucking bunch of religious fuckers who are against psychedelics. Well, no, it's not. And then someone else on the other side might say, well, it's a bunch of, atheist fucking hippies.
Socialist hippies.
Everyone to, yeah, exactly. To take drugs instead of go to church. And no, it's not. Like, it's actually, you know, some blend of both. So, actually, I should say blend of both.
Serious treatment.
Yeah.
Well, it might be a blend of both. Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? So, okay. Is there any final things you want to say, or was that last statement of
yours. I think that's good. We're going to wind up cracking into another big nut, and it's probably best that we save it for, you know, when we have another couple hours, not just a few minutes at the end.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right, my friend. Well, look, enjoy the sunshine where you are.
Thank you.
I'm going to get back to the darkness where I am, and and yeah, we'll chat soon. Okay.
It's always a pleasure. I really appreciate these conversations. And as you just said, I think they're super important. And I think there's a definite hunger for these as we continue to wrestle with the state of the world as it is and try to figure out the best way to move forward. So I always appreciate you being a willing and capable dance partner for these conversations.
For sure, brother. Thank you, man.
All right, brother. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Wake Up Podcast. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. I'll try and read them each week and send you a shout out. And remember to grab a copy of the Uncommunist Manifesto and join us in defeating the plague that is consuming our world.